We welcome back to the program author Colin Fleming. Check out his works like Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963, or with the holiday season fast approaching. If you haven't read it yet, wonderful for you to read. Also might make a pretty fine holiday gift, too. Colin's wonderful work, Scrooge, taking a look at the 1951 film. Colin Fleming joining us. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, how's it going?
Going very well, thank you, on this this day before the first snow of the season. Always exciting.
Oh, snow up there. Any snow here? Do you know? I don't think so.
I think too warm there. We're not going to get much, an inch, if that. So, yeah, we'll see, but it's that time of year.
It's on last night, 2 days ago. I think it's 2 days ago. Shorts weather outside, and then firing up the heat last night. Couldn't go any longer. Changes fast.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we got a lot of things to cover today, and I want to start with another great episode of the radio version of Gunsmoke. And you wrote about it on the blog. It's Gunsmoke about as good as anything out there in the history of radio dramas.
For consistency, yes. There were other series where they might not have been as strong as Gunsmoke, but they had individual episodes that could rise to the level. But Gunsmoke pretty much came out of the chute in 1952. If you listen to the early episodes, they change some, the characters, the dynamics, but it was pretty well established as quality right from the first episode, and it continued without a drop in quality the entire way through.
And it's
an episode. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's remarkable that it was running at this level of quality for many of those years while the television series was airing.
Yeah, that would have been. I wonder at the time if people had their loyalty split and you were almost like New York baseball and someone said, Willie, Mickey, and the Duke, who you got? And except it was TV, Gunsmoke, or radio, Gunsmoke, because they're so different. I saw an episode last night, though, of The Twilight Zone and TV Gunsmoke. Chester was on it. And I wasn't looking at first, and I heard his voice, and it sounded quite a bit like Parley Bear from the radio. So I think there was some alignment that was happening. And if you listen to Georgia Ellis, who's Kitty on the radio program, she sounds a lot like Amanda Blake in some ways. So I think they were trying to line that up. Now, James Arnest doesn't really sound like William Conrad, but he can a little bit in terms of having that authoritarian type of voice. And obviously they didn't look alike, but they didn't have to look alike. So this episode that I had mentioned to you is one where it's called Kitty's Cot, where she is, this Kitty is taken away, and she's abducted by these guys who were going to do really bad stuff to her. And Chester Proudfoot and Marshall Dillon have to go out on the trail to try to rescue her, although it doesn't seem terribly likely at first that they're going to be returning to Dodge with an intact Miss Kitty.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it's going too well at all. I laughed, too, when you were talking about the vocal qualities of the actors there. I thought in this episode we got a little bit of Floyd, the barber, in Howard McNear's portrayal.
Howard McNear, he's so good as Doc. He is, I think he's probably my favorite character in the radio version. Whenever he comes into a scene, I'm glad to have him there, that I perk up even a little bit more. And something I like about this episode, too, is how composed Matt Dillon is, because he has this love, and it's a romantic love, that's not consummated in the outwardly expressed sense. I don't even mean the physical sense. I mean like we're together, because he's just kind of on his own because of the nature of his job. And he has to witness her being taken right in front of him. There's nothing he can do about that. And he knows that she's probably going to be killed. And he still stays so composed throughout the episode. It really is a great lesson in staying focused on the task at hand, including when, it's kind of funny, and I'm sure this part made you laugh, when this happens a lot in Westerns, you're out there, you're already dealing with a lot of problems, and then you hear that baby rattle. But there's no child lurking behind that bush. It's a rattler. So they have the hideout staked out, Chester and Matt Dillon, when a snake comes out. And they can't make any noise, because if they make any noise, the two marauders are going to kill Kitty. So they come up, Matt Dillon comes up with a plan to have the rattlesnake killed by Chester.
Are you chewing, Chester? That's my favorite line.
Yeah, it's a good time to be a tobacco chewer. And then Dillon, he kind of like ribs them too. He's like, you're always bragging about how good you spit. and then he said, can you hit him? And Chester is like, I don't know if I can do it. He ends up hitting the snake right between his snaky eyes and the rattlesnake. That's rude. And he goes off. The guys come out of the hideout with Miss Kitty. I love this. I like when it's time to stop effing around. You know what I mean? They snipe these two guys. They just shoot them from up above. Headshot. Boom. Done. Boom. Done. And they go down and Miss Kitty's okay.
Yeah, and I love the way that Matt Dillon just explains to Chester, look, yes, that's exactly what we're doing. You got the one on the left.
Oh, it's cool. Chester, he said, because Chester's sporting about it. It's okay to hang a man and all of that and go through the process and whatever, to fire. But it seems to go against Chester's sense of fair play. And are we really going to do this? Are we just going to shoot these guys? And you're right. Dillon just walks him through it and then tells him how they're divvying up the two people. And you get this sense, too, that they're both such, obviously we know Matt Dillon is, but Chester's just a crack shot. This is easy. This isn't like amazing shooting. Can't believe we did it. It's simply Steph Curry before the game knocking down threes. Like, he never misses. It doesn't even hit the rim. And Chester has that, I don't know. It's nice to see that he has that sniping ability, too.
So I was watching an old movie called Tension on TCM the other night, and I was doing some other things, but I heard a voice, and I thought, well, that's Marshall Dillon. Well, sure enough, there was William Conrad in this film from, I think, 1949.
William Conrad is in an awful, awful lot of things, film noir and everything. But when I encounter him elsewhere, even on the radio, he's really good on the radio. He was that intro sort of voice at the beginning of Escape and how your life sucks and don't you want to escape and all of that. He really epitomizes this character, though. This was his character. This was his role. He was versatile enough that he wouldn't be typecast, but this suited his acting abilities perfectly, to the point where when I see him in anything else, it's just not the same, because he was so good at this. It was almost really as if the part was written for him to play, or he just found a way to embrace it and understood that it could come across as though it were written for him to play. But you see him as like a heavy in a film noir, and I just think that's Matt Dillon. He wouldn't be like this cheap thug. He's so much more magnanimous than that. And I think that's how he always comes across on Gunsmoke, is this magnanimous person of extreme rectitude. And you don't get that with some of his like heavy and tough guy and muscly parts.
No, and a guy too, and you touched on it in his relationship with Kitty, who sacrifices oftentimes his own happiness to do what's best for the folks of the town.
He does, and there's that confessional at the beginning of the episode. It's not there in the first few, where the main character, who's this tough guy who shoots people, all this stuff, he tells us he's lonely. That's highly unusual. Mm. Think of how unusual that would have been in the 1950s, that in the post-war times, and here is some guy saying that, and you had a different traditional family dynamic at the time. And at the same time, though, he talks about being lonely, but he has three amazing friends that we know of. And those friends are, they're quite different from each other. He's getting different things out of those three different relationships. They're such distinctive personalities. So, yes, he's lonely, but how many people have three amazing friends that are just that true and that loyal and such cool people, really, such capable people? They're all, the three of them are so capable in their distinctive ways, in their talents. Chester, too, because you sort of think after a while, like, Chester's just kind of this go-along. He's not. And there are episodes where Chester's on his own or Dylan has given him some responsibility to look over some kid or something like that. And we see that he's a highly capable individual. Mm-hmm. So there's just a lot going on emotionally, psychologically, in addition to all of the bang, bang, shoot them up type of stuff.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Up next, a holiday special from Hanna-Barbera. I must have missed this because I would have been of the age to see this when it came out in the early 70s, but I watched it and I have no recollection of seeing the Thanksgiving that almost wasn't.
With Jeremy Squirrel?
With Jeremy Squirrel, yeah.
It's kind of a precursor, plot-wise, to 1974's Rankin Bass, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, because you have humans, and then you have the animal family version of the human and the bespectacled father and everything. And Thanksgiving is a holiday where it's lost a lot of its pizzazz in the world, definitely. It's almost like an afterthought now. You go to the Starbucks, there's one lonely bag of the Thanksgiving blend coffee, and the Christmas coffee already dwarfs it. And there's not a lot of outstanding Thanksgiving literature and films and TV specials. So this was an attempt, I think, to fill a void and to teach a kind of history lesson at the same time. And the pilgrims come over, they go through that first winter, it's a bad time, and it's a modern squirrel family telling the story about their ancestor, Jeremy Squirrel. And a Native American boy and the pilgrim boy the next year get lost, and Jeremy Squirrel, who strangely had both complimented them and given them a mini lecture on what amazing hunters they were, which is something you'd think you'd want to steer clear of if you were a squirrel, and especially food being scant. But he does it anyways. Like, you're both such amazing hunters. Like, I don't know, man. Maybe lay off that. He sort of saves the day. It's very Ben and me, Ben Franklin and his mouse. And we find out at the end, the modern day squirrel family is having their Thanksgiving repast, which is a walnut, an excellent snack, by the way, that Jeremy Squirrel, he's not even really dead. He's just kind of frozen in an oil painting, and he snacks on an acorn that he has tucked away on his person. So I don't know what's going on with that, if he's eternal, if he's a squirrel god, but there you go.
And some great voice talent, including the awesome June Foray.
Yeah, the sounds of this episode, the voices, the songs, they're pretty ear catching, and some of the rhymes, some high level poetry. as like one of them goes, "I hope you're carving because I'm a starving." There's a lot of that, but I mean, it's sort of it's like a low rent Rankin Bass special. Hanna-Barbera, they didn't really do this kind of thing. It makes you appreciate Rankin Bass, because even when you see the ones that aren't celebrated, they're quite, they end up getting stuck in your head, a lot of those songs and everything. And here, we're not quite crossing over into like a Shaggy 70s vibe, but we're just on the other side of it. Like, at any point we could break out into some proto funk rhythms, and you feel like maybe that was in the soundtrack originally, and some producers said, no, we can't be going in that direction. We're going back to the 17th century here and all that jazz. But it's fun, and you know what? Frankly, you don't have a lot of viewing options
for this kind of thing for Thanksgiving. So suck it up and experience the Thanksgiving that almost wasn't.
You know, I don't think we've talked with you either about Jules Bass, who passed away just a few weeks ago, and what a big impact he made in his partnership with, was it Alan Rankin?
Yeah, he definitely did, and it touched, I feel like you come into this world and you gather your consciousness, and once you do, your first thought should be, how can I impact people to the good? And Jules Bass really did that. Those specials made so many people happy. I don't mean that they provided them with like actual happiness, but they brightened moments. They maybe were a comfort. They were something to look forward to when they were happy in the rest of their life, and boost an evening and make it even better. I love all the Rankin Bass specials, every single one. If you do watch Rudolph, though, and I'm sure it'll come up in the following weeks, and you know the entire oeuvre, Rudolph is at such a high level compared. It's almost like the first Star Wars. It's just so much better than everything that came after it. It really was their greatest hit, but all of it is worth, it's worth seeing. And when you see Rankin Bass, you don't just see one of these productions once. You see it over and over and over again, because it's like a potato chip. It's not like a one-and-done kind of thing.
All right, we want to talk music. Carrie, can we cue this up and give a listen? I have to say, first of all, I had no idea about Shakers and singing. I want to give a listen to this. This is called Pretty Home. It's a short piece, about a minute 15. Let's give a listen.
Oh, my pretty mother's home, sweeter than the honey in the comb.
Oh, my pretty mother's home, sweeter than the honey in the comb.
Come, love, pretty love, come, love, pretty love, I want some.
Come, love, pretty love, come, love, pretty love, I want some.
Oh, my pretty father's home, sweeter than the honey in the comb.
Oh, my pretty father's home, sweeter than the honey in the comb.
Come, love, pretty love, come, love, pretty love, I want some.
Come, love, pretty love, come.
Shakers getting down there, Colin.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that so much. That's we should mention them too. That's the Boston Camerata, and this is a number of years ago that recording was made. Shakers of Sabbath Day Lake, and Boston Camerata is just one of the best institutions, I feel, in Boston. And so, if people listening are going to be in the area for the holiday, they have these amazing holiday concerts. I go to a lot of things. In Boston Camerata, it's historical music done the right way. It's just one of the best. Anything I go to by them is one of the best things I go to, period. And I don't say that lightly. You get a life experience, you get a musical education, and you get just awesome stuff like this. Their Gloucestershire Wassail is going to get you going. It's the awesome Christmas drinking song of all time. And if you're like me and don't drink alcohol, you will pound a steam cider to it. So the Shakers were these fiercely rhythmic musical people. And so what you're really hearing there, in many ways, that's rhythm and blues.
I listened to that and I thought, man, there are some solid gospel overtones here.
If you listen to Clyde McFadder's Itty Bitty Pretty One, it's pretty much what you just heard, like the same meter, the same beat, and listening to that Boston Camerata song there. You hear the stomping of the boots, and that's something that like you'll notice at a concert. You don't even like know you're doing it, like everybody is doing it. So there's a highly rhythmic edge to
the music the Shakers made. The Shaker music was usually monodic, meaning we're not going to get harmony. And that can be a lot of rhythm and blues. You know, we have backing singers and all of that stuff. But again, if you listen to that Clyde McFadder famous rendition of Itty Bitty Pretty One, it's his voice driving along like a main voice, like we heard with the woman there. And it's proceeding in that similar, like monodic kind of way. So we think of rhythm and blues as this urban mid-20th century art form, but it had these earlier, not offshoots, almost like pre-shoots, and the Shakers were certainly, a lot of their music was in this rhythmic mode.
Well, it's soul-stirring music, and then you also sent along another recording from the Enfield Shaker Singers in Enfield, New Hampshire, and it was there were some similarities, but it was also a different, in some ways, less rhythmic sound.
Yeah, that would be, I feel like this is the song people know Shaker music, they're most likely to know. It's the one that goes, come, come, Shaker life, come life eternal, shake out of me all that is carnal. The Shakers were a people who were fiercely accepting. They accepted everyone in a real way. So, for instance, during the Civil War, Shaker people wouldn't fight. They didn't believe in killing anyone for any reason, defense of a country, nothing like that. And a number of soldiers on both sides of that divide found succor and comfort and hospitality in Shaker communities. So they would proselytize, certainly, and the religious service was a big part of that. And it's the same idea kind of with gospel, when you're going to get all of these other musical art forms that grow out of the church and become highly secular. A lot of the secularity is carried via that rhythm. You have the same thing happening here. It's just a different church, but a kind of similar idea. And anyone who thinks Shaker music, religious music, that can't be fun, this is some of my favorite music of all time. I listen to things like this. Oh, I don't go a week without listening to that Golden Harvest record from Boston Camerata. So I would, it's very modern music. I would, eternal music, timeless music. So I would recommend a thorough investigation too.
Mm. Well, we have some familiarity with the Shakers because of the Sabbath Day Lake settlement here in Maine, but Carrie and I were talking earlier, and I don't know if there are any left. They were down at one point a few years ago to just two people left there.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, because what's interesting about the Shaker religion is there's a huge emphasis in celibacy, so that's not something the young people are going to be interested in, but it's almost a religious port in the storm. It's a transitional religion in some ways. And I don't mean that in any disrespectful regard, but the people struggling, looking for acceptance and tolerance, find repose in the Shaker community and lifestyle. And the music, of course, lives on. And Shaker furniture, people out there, I don't know if Antiques Roadshow is still on.
Oh, yes.
Would always come in with like a piece of Shaker furniture. It's like you have an Eames chair, you have a vintage Shaker chair. They're equally desirable aesthetically. And so they poured a lot of themselves into craft and songsmithing. And so, of course, I naturally am inclined to be drawn towards that. But their level of detail and things of that nature, it comes from a focus. They were always equal rights for everybody. There was no, okay, in the church, it's going to be the guy and the women take a back seat. It was never that way for Shakers. Man, woman, everyone, same opportunity, the same. There's a lot that we can take from that life and certainly that music.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Finally, we want to talk about those Red Hot Bruins, 14-2 record. great start to the tenure of Jim Montgomery as head coach of the team. Well, what's been the secret to their success so far?
14-2. What are they? 2004 and 2003 Patriots. That's crazy. That's a hockey record that you don't see that often. And I was bothered when they got rid of Bruce Cassidy, primarily because he was too mean. Because I like mean people who expect other people to get things done. That's just, I don't know. That appeals to me. It's accountability and everything. But they are doing so much better. I mean, worlds better than I thought they'd be doing with McAvoy and Marchand, the two best players who were going to be out for not as long as they turned to be out, and some older guys coming back, and I'm shocked, and really, and it's legitimate too, because I'm not shocked when I watch them. I'm seeing even third and fourth line production. Patrice Bergeron, who I've always thought was overrated, but very good, because they're not mutually exclusive. He shouldn't hang him up after the end of this season. And then Marchand come back, and you have that surgery on both hips, and you're his age, which is older for a hockey player. I really wondered if he would be ever close to the same, because so much of his game is quickness, not speed. It's quickness. First game out there, the guy looks better than he's looked in some time. This is, anything can happen in the NHL playoffs. It is the great wilderness of all the postseason tournaments, right? Like maybe the NCAA basketball tournament. You can be the best team and get knocked off in the NHL playoffs. But this team is, it's like 82-83 Bruins, but better. They weren't compiling a record like this, close to this early on.
And riding a hot goaltender, which never hurts.
And he's probably, or maybe not, the goalie that you expected to be that hot goaltender in Ullmark. I think, like, Swayman, right? Ullmark is a capable NHL goalie. Right now, he's a Vezina level. He would be the Vezina winner right now. And for him to be, things happen. Swayman gets dinged up, and things also can snowball pretty quickly at the start of the season. Like, one goalie is red hot, the other goalie has like kind of outing, and then a not so good outing. The other guy comes back in and shuts the opponent down. That happened with Tim Thomas and Rask that year that they won the cup. Thomas already had the Vezina, and then he had that down year, and Rask looked like the guy, and it just ended up going to Thomas again early on and took it. These guys are just going out there and taking, they're winning on back-to-back nights. They won a game, I think it was last week, where they didn't have anything. They were fumbling the puck. You just have games you're going to lose unless you're so much better than the opponent. It's not an effort thing. It's just a kind of stuff catching up with you thing. And they still won that game. That's when I thought that was the game that was most encouraging to me. I thought,
was that the game where they fell behind early 2-0?
Yeah, and they were just, everything was sloppy. Do you know what I mean? Like, it almost like they were going over patches of ice that the other team wasn't. Just unforced turnovers, like from sloppy stick handling. And it just happens. You play a lot of games, you've played like on the road, whatever it might be. And it's also, you're playing, these guys are professionals. You're always playing someone awesome. Even, like, the bad team, everyone's awesome. So that's just what happens. When you win those games at that level, when you're not even playing well, that's what the elite teams do. And I don't know what they're going to be 2 months from now, but they're obviously, like, elite. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, like, do you know what the next best Bruins record is through this many games? I don't know, but can't be close to this.
I certainly don't remember in my lifetime of watching them anything remotely close to this.
82-83 was that year where they had the best record. And the reason I mentioned that instead of like 1990 where they had the best record was because it really was hard to have the best record in 82-83 because you had the Oilers and the Islanders. So for the Bruins to do that, it was surprising. Everything had to go right. That was the year that Pete Peters won the Vezina, and Ray Bourque and Middleton and Peterson, and they were awesome. The recently departed
Peter McNabb was still there. Like, all of those guys. Keith Crowder was good. All of those players were pretty much as good as they got. Brad Park was a little bit older. I went back through, like, the game by game. You can do that in Hockey Reference. They were nothing like this at the beginning of the season. And they picked it up later, and everything kind of went right for them. But things aren't just going right for these Bruins. They're better than everyone right now. And then they got McAvoy back, who might be their best player at this point. And I'm sure he was raring to go because his partner would be the Norris Trophy winner right now. And I don't know where that came from. He's good. He reminds me a bit of who was the guy, Chara's guy, Seidenberg, on the, on the 2011 team. So he's like that first pairing number two guy, but he's the best defenseman in hockey right now.
Well, it's a fun ride here early on, a 14-2 start for the Bruins, who are back at it against the Flyers on Thursday. Colin Fleming joins us every Tuesday here on Downtown. Thank you much, Colin, as always, and we'll check in again next week.
All right, sounds good.